thank you very much, Cathy, for your generous introduction, and I'd like to thank the Australian Human Rights Commission for inviting me today to address you on complementary protection. Now, this is a topic that has suffered somewhat from... I don't need the slides yet, so I'll, okay. You do that. Has suffered somewhat from a little bit of a mistaken identity. A former immigration minister in the previous government said, "We're not about providing free protection." She was, I think, thinking it was spelt differently, complementary protection. But I think part of the difficulty with the concept is that it doesn't have a uniform meaning. So as Cathy highlighted in her introduction, complementary protection describes international legal obligations that states have undertaken either through international treaties, principally the Convention Against Torture and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but also complementary protection can describe additional customary international law obligations that states have, through their practice and their statements, have assumed beyond treaty law. So, for example, extending to protecting people who in some situations are fleeing civil war or generalised violence. Importantly, though, the notion of complementary protection is that we're talking about protection whose source is in an instrument or in a legal basis that is itself complementary to the Refugee Convention. So that's where the complementary comes in. It's defined in relation to refugee law, although it has developed more broadly through human rights law. The main kinds of issues that we talk about, or bases of complementary protection that we talk about, are people who are fleeing a credible risk of torture or cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. Those obligations derive from the ICCPR and the torture one from the Convention Against Torture, as well as people who are fleeing the death penalty. And that, as I'll show on the slides, also comes from the ICCPR and the optional protocol there too. The chief function of complementary protection is to provide an alternative basis for eligibility for protection, as well as a status. So what we're talking about here is two things, really. Threshold eligibility, which are these things like fear of torture, cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment and so on, and then the status that ought to be granted. What I would argue is that if we're talking about protection in this way, then we're not necessarily talking about something that necessarily mandates a lesser duration of status or a lesser quality of status, but rather what we're doing is assessing international protection needs by using different instruments, different legal principles, and coming up with a basis on which people are deserving of protection, which I would argue mandates equal treatment, both as a matter of law and policy. Complementary protection is a feature of most developed countries' protection regimes, including throughout the 27 member states of the European Union, throughout the US and Canada, and it's currently before the New Zealand Parliament in the large immigration bill. New Zealand has already, the courts have already recognised complementary protection as, you know, as a principle, and this will codify protection on the basis of Article 6 and 7 of the ICCPR and Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture. In 2005, the Executive Committee of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which is comprised of around 70 countries, including Australia, adopted a conclusion encouraging states to implement forms of complementary protection in national law. And up until now, the Australian government has not acted on that conclusion. However, there is currently, hot off the press, a model that has been drafted by the Immigration Department, which is being commented on over the next couple of weeks by academics and the NGO sector, which is a welcome initiative because for a very long time, we've had the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, we've had academics, NGOs, we've had kind of calls in the Executive Committee of UNHCR encouraging states and Australia in particular to translate its international obligations into domestic law. And I think that's the fundamental point here, that under international law, Australia has already accepted that it will never send somebody back to face torture or the death penalty or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. But what it's failed to do is to provide a basis in Australian law whereby somebody can actually trigger that. And so that's where the gap has been. So the absence of complementary protection in Australia has meant that the only basis on which somebody seeking asylum could apply for protection was if they said that they met the refugee definition that comes from Article 182 of the Refugee Convention and is reflected in Section 36 of the Migration Act. So just to remind us, a refugee, as defined in the Convention, is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution, who's outside their country of origin, whose country of origin is unable or unwilling to protect them, and whose well-founded fear of being persecuted is on account of their nationality, political opinion, race, religion, or their membership in a particular social group. Now, obviously, somebody fearing torture is necessarily fearing persecution. I don't think there would be many people who would try to argue that torture wasn't a form of persecution. But the problem is that in some cases a person will not be able to show that the reason that they are being tortured is because of their race or their religion and so on. So by being unable to make that link, that person would automatically fall outside that definition, and in Australia would not have any other legislative basis on which they could claim protection. What this has meant is that somebody in that position, if they've sought to obtain protection in Australia, has nevertheless had to go through a long and convoluted process of trying to make out a refugee claim on this basis, getting a negative decision, appealing to the Refugee Review Tribunal, again getting a rejection, and then seeking to use the Minister's public interest powers under Section 417 of the Migration Act to argue a case based on the torture claim. Now, the Minister has a set of guidelines, and there's actually a unit in the Department that will assess most of those, we'll get the cases in and assess them against the guidelines. But as far as the legislation is concerned, this is a non-compellable and non-reviewable discretion that the Minister has. So even though there is a process in place whereby the thousands of applications lodged are assessed against guidelines that include reference to things like the Convention Against Torture and the ICCPR, there is no requirement in law for the Minister to even entertain that application, and even if he does and rejects it, there is no basis on which that decision can be reviewed. That is, and the other point is that that's a very laborious way of getting to a point where that claim can be assessed in the first place. What complementary protection does is bring everything up front, so that a person is assessed through a single procedure. Their claim is assessed first against this definition, and if they are found not to meet that definition, then the claim can be assessed against some of the other grounds, which I'll go through. One of the primary concerns I think that a lot of people have about complementary protection is that it may water down refugee status, and that can be in a couple of reasons articulated for that. One is that it may stultify the jurisprudence, in that decision makers may say, well, this case might fit this definition, but I'm not really sure, so I'll just jump to one of the complementary protection grounds. The effect of that being that refugee law jurisprudence isn't developed. The notion of persecution, which has been very much informed by human rights law, may not be developed further. There is a concern about that, which from some of the international experience may not be completely misplaced, but I don't think it's an adequate reason for saying we shouldn't have complementary protection at all. The second reason is in relation to the status that people get. There are some academics in particular who will argue very, very strongly that refugee status is a privileged status that only refugees should have, and no one else ought to have that same kind of protection. Again, I think this argument is perhaps based on a fear of what governments may or may not be willing to do. And as state practice shows, even in the jurisdictions where a kind of hierarchical status has been put in place, like the European Union, most governments are in fact according, in real terms, an identical status because of the practical difficulties in according different rights to different people, the issues of appeal, of people trying to upgrade their status, as well as kind of a fundamental human dignity argument, which is that there is really no legal basis for distinguishing people's protection needs, you know, whether they arise under the Refugee Convention or whether they arise under the Convention Against Torture. And so the argument would be, you know, why should somebody why should somebody's healthcare entitlements in Australia depend on whether or not their protection need stems from this or stems from the Convention Against Torture? And that's an argument that UNHCR, certainly in the European context, has supported. The House of Lords has articulated. A number of governments have said that as well. Canada has a single status, and I think I believe very strongly that that's the approach Australia should take, and that seems to be favoured by the current government. So the current government's position, which is to move forward on this issue, signals a shift from the long-standing view of the previous government, which really played on the differences that I mentioned at the beginning between some of the complementary protection systems in place around the world, to suggest firstly that there was no single concept of what it entailed, so it was, you know, too difficult to implement it here. And secondly, through the argument that Australia already respected its non-refoulement obligations through the ministerial intervention opportunity and also through Australia's offshore humanitarian program. Now, neither of these arguments was accurate. I've already addressed the ministerial discretion one. But in terms of the offshore humanitarian program, as you may know, Australia has both an onshore program for people who arrive and seek asylum within Australia, as well as a kind of quota system offshore for people who are, for example, in refugee camps abroad, who have been designated by UNHCR as refugees and who Australia takes in on an annual basis, selects a number of people who can come and resettle here. And under that program, we not only take people who meet this definition, but other people as well, such as women at risk. And there are some other special humanitarian categories as well. Now, although the offshore program contains both refugee and humanitarian visas, it also requires applicants to be able to demonstrate family or community links to Australia and to be sponsored by an Australian resident, organisation or family member. So you need a sponsor here. So in this way, offshore humanitarian protection is not a pure protection category per se, and it certainly is founded on some of the human rights treaties that complementary protection is, but it doesn't have those categories clearly in place. And furthermore, the number of humanitarian visas granted is circumscribed by an annual quota, which affords the government considerable latitude in the selection and admission of applicants. So while humanitarian need forms part of the eligibility threshold, those who are ultimately selected will not necessarily be those most in need of protection. So again, I'm not trying to criticise the offshore humanitarian program. It's a very important part of Australia's refugee program, but it doesn't kind of make up for the lack of complementary protection onshore. As I've alluded to, there are a number of treaties which give rise to these international obligations on which complementary protection is based. So the first is Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture, which says that no state party shall expel, return or extradite a person to another state where there are substantial grounds for believing that he or she would be in danger of being subjected to torture. This is an obligation that states can never derogate from. So what this also means is that there are no exclusion clauses. I'll come to a slide of the convention exclusion clauses in a moment, but basically if somebody does have, or if there are substantial grounds for believing that somebody would be in danger of being subjected to torture, they're in Australia, we can establish this, then Australia can never remove them to that country while such a risk exists. And that is something that I think has been, I mean, the legislation around the world shows that's a little bit of a sticking point for governments. They don't know what to do with people whom they don't want to be able, who they, you know, who might be, have committed serious criminal offences and so on, but whom they are obliged to protect. And so there's then a question of, well, what status do those people get? Secondly, under the ICCPR, we have the same non-removal to torture, but also to cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. Now, that is an implicit non-return provision. A parallel provision in the European Convention on Human Rights has been interpreted through the European Court of Human Rights as mandating states not to return people to such treatment. That view has also been supported by the Human Rights Committee, and it's generally accepted that that is an implicit non-return provision. Similarly, Article 6, which says that every human being has the inherent right to life and no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of life. And the second optional protocol, which says that no party to the present protocol shall execute anybody. And that has been interpreted by the Human Rights Committee as preventing states that have themselves outlawed the death penalty from sending people back to other countries where that person is at risk of the death penalty. There's also considerable state practice from Europe and under the regional African and Latin American conventions which extend protection to people fleeing from civil war and generalised violence. So I've just put up these two regional treaties. These basically grant refugee status to people compelled to leave for any of the following reasons. This isn't kind of seen as classic complementary protection, but the argument that I'm making is that around the world there is considerable state practice that people should not be sent back to these kinds of events either. Complementary protection regimes around the world vary in the precise language that is used to implement these treaty obligations and broader customary law obligations, as well as in the status that results from them. So if I can just turn briefly to a few of these to give you a flavour of how complementary protection operates. In the European Union, in April 2004, a piece of supranational legislation known as the Qualification Directive was adopted. The aim of it was to harmonise asylum practices across the European Union through cementing what was understood by the refugee definition, as well as the additional complementary protection grounds on which people in any EU member state could obtain protection. The legislation was not designed as a, you know, let's start from the beginning and create something new, but rather as an amalgamation of existing state practice. So it was a little bit of a lowest common denominator approach, which is why it shouldn't necessarily be held up as, you know, this is the best model we've got. What it does is establish a framework of European law, and national law has to comply with it. So again, this gets translated into the law of the member states. Complementary protection in the EU is known as subsidiary protection, which reflects the hierarchical status. So a convention refugee gets a better set of rights, slightly higher set of rights, than does a beneficiary of subsidiary protection. But as I mentioned, in practice, most countries are actually affording the same level of rights. Article 2E defines who a person eligible for subsidiary protection is, and basically it's somebody who would face a real risk of suffering serious harm as defined in Article 15. Article 15 defines serious harm in the following way. Death penalty or execution, torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment in the country of origin, and that's actually, you know, a narrowing down of that, the scope of that provision, or a serious and individual threat to a civilian's life or person by reason of indiscriminate violence in situations of international or internal armed conflict. That last provision has caused an enormous amount of confusion for a number of reasons. What is an individual threat in a situation of indiscriminate violence? Particularly given that there's a kind of preambular section that says risks that are faced by general population don't count as individual risks. What is indiscriminate violence? What is a situation of international or internal armed conflict? Is that something that has to meet that status in international humanitarian law? Or is it something that we could just generally describe as a situation of armed conflict? What this means is that across the EU, in some countries, if you come from Iraq, that fits. In other countries, they don't see Iraq as fitting that definition. So in terms of harmonising protection across the EU, I think governments actually outsmarted themselves and created a provision that's unworkable. So in the review that was just had of this, the European Commission said this is something that really needs attention because it's just not working. The Netherlands actually submitted submitted something to the European Court of Justice, which has the power to kind of make rulings on the meaning of certain terms. And although the court itself hasn't pronounced on this, the Advocate General, who issues a preliminary opinion, has said that in his view, what this means is that the more the person or the more a person is individually affected, the less it will be necessary to show that he faces indiscriminate violence in his country or a part of the territory which is so serious that there is a serious risk that he will be a victim of it himself. Likewise, the less the person is able to show that he is individually affected, the more the violence must be serious and indiscriminate for him to be eligible for the subsidiary protection claimed. So whether or not the court itself picks up on that interpretation remains to be seen. My point here is that I think it's important to have a provision that extends to these kinds of situations, but it needs to be much better defined than that to be operable. In Canada, the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act defines, firstly in Section 96, refugees, and secondly in Section 97, and I'm sorry about the formatting, it looked really good on my computer, but a person in need of protection is basically somebody who faces a personal danger of being tortured within the meaning of the Convention Against Torture, or somebody who, and this is in paragraph B, faces a risk to their life or a risk of cruel and unusual treatment or punishment, which is the Canadian version of cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, provided the following conditions are met. Firstly, that the person can't avail themselves of the protection of that country. Secondly, that the risk would be faced by the person in every part of that country and is not faced generally by other individuals in or from that country. Thirdly, that the risk isn't inherent or incidental to lawful sanctions. And finally, that the risk is not caused by the inability of that country to provide adequate health or medical care. Now, this exemption of health and medical care from the meaning of inhuman or degrading treatment is something that a number of governments have implemented. Although it doesn't appear in the European law itself, that is the interpretation that it's been given by the European Court of Human Rights. So that the only way that you could say, you know, if I can't get medical care in my own country and I will die as a result if you send me back there, you have to show absolutely exceptional circumstances for that ever to be a ground on which you can obtain protection. again, these are policy reasons for constraining the meaning of those treaty terms, although they don't come from, you know, they're not in the treaty themselves. In the US, complementary protection is based only on the Convention Against Torture. So there's something called withholding of removal under the Convention Against Torture, which is the kind of better protection. There's also something called deferral of removal, which is basically where you've been convicted of an aggravated felony, you know, serious crime, but because protection under the Convention Against Torture is absolute, the United States can't actually get rid of you, so they say, well, we'll basically let you stay here, but we can keep you in detention until we can remove you. So it's a very, very basic level of non-removal. By contrast, withholding of removal gives you work rights, gives you certain social security rights. The main difference between that and refugee status in the States is that under refugee status you can apply for family reunification and permanent residence, whereas you can't under the withholding of removal provision. In New Zealand, and I don't have a slide for that, in New Zealand, the bill before Parliament basically implements the protection against torture, inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment, as well as protection from arbitrary deprivation of life. So again, based on Article 6 and 7 of the ICCPR and Article 3 of CAT. In terms of status, I've already mentioned that the European Union has a differentiated status, at least in theory. In New Zealand, the status is not yet defined, and so it remains unclear whether beneficiaries would get the same rights as convention refugees have in New Zealand, or whether they would have some sort of lower status. In Canada, people get exactly the same status. And what's interesting is that in Canada, probably only 2 or 3 people a year are ever protected under that, you know, torture-based protection. Now, the question is why? And the answer seems to be that Canada has still quite expansive and, you know, not necessarily generous, but broad understandings and interpretations of persecution under the Refugee Convention. By contrast, a lot of European countries have much narrower understandings of what constitutes persecution. So when we compare figures, we have to be alert to how are these definitions even being used? Because if you've got a very narrow conception of the Refugee Convention definition, then almost by necessity you're going to have more people falling into these complementary categories. By contrast, in Canada, the broader understanding of persecution, the refugee definition, means fewer people come in through complementary protection. And from talking to people overseas about the position in Australia, I think there's a little bit of a fear that because Australia already has quite a human rights approach to interpreting the Refugee Convention, it's very important that the introduction of complementary protection doesn't lead to a kind of watering down of our jurisprudence there and our understanding of the scope of the Refugee Convention. As I mentioned, the Australian model seems to propose, or certainly in discussions with the Minister, it seems that there's a favouring of providing an identical status to beneficiaries of complementary protection, which I think is entirely appropriate. The final point I just wanted to raise is that of exclusion. Under the Refugee Convention, people can be excluded from protection if they've committed serious crimes, so crime against humanity, a war crime, a crime against peace, or a serious non-political crime outside the country of refuge prior to admission, or if the person has been guilty of acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the UN. And that was a deliberate decision when the Refugee Convention was drafted, that some people were undeserving of protection. And the underlying rationale was that other countries shouldn't be harbouring war criminals. These exclusion clauses do not exist under broader complementary protection, under the international obligations, which means that it's an absolute prohibition on return. And you can understand that for many governments, if they're faced with someone who has committed one of these things, who they would previously have been able to say, well, you're not a refugee, we can't remove them, and so what do we do? This is an area which I don't think any country has properly addressed. I think there's a real sense that this is too hard. In the drafting of the EU directive, there just was really very, very little discussion of this. It was kind of pushed to one side. And it's really been left to the discretion of individual governments as to what they do. The bottom line is that people can't be removed. But I think it's also very important to recognise that everybody retains human rights, and so we cannot simply keep people in detention forever because we think they're undesirable people. So it's important to assess what is the level of danger that this person actually poses to the Australian community. Has that person been convicted of a crime, or are they simply suspected of having committed a crime? All these issues need to be properly thought through in terms of then deciding, well, what rights, what status, what liberties does that person have within our jurisdiction? And that remains, I think, a challenge around the world in terms of, complementary protection. A couple of other things that have been omitted from all these models are statelessness. And statelessness is one of the, we know from the Al-Khateb case, for example, statelessness is one of the really big issues that needs to be addressed, and that we don't have a protection visa category for. We do have two statelessness treaties, but again, the problem with those is they haven't been properly implemented around the world. So statelessness is a big issue that does need to be addressed, and complementary protection would be a mechanism for doing that. Similarly, civil war and generalised violence only appears in the EU. Well, that's something else we need to consider too. And there's also a question about are certain rights being privileged here. What about social and economic and cultural rights? Why aren't they there? Do we have to be feeding those through this concept of inhuman or degrading treatment, or should they separately be able to form a basis on which protection might be claimed? Obviously, when Australia does have such a system in place, the interpretive tools that decision makers use are necessarily going to be broadened to looking at international law sources, at comparative law sources. I think it's going to require a more comparative approach in the jurisprudence, but also a principled understanding of how these terms have been developed at the international level and at the regional level, so that we don't end up with a whole range of different national interpretations about what all these terms mean. So that was a quick race through comparative complementary protection around the world, and I'd be very happy to take any questions that you might have. Do you want to do that? No?
Thanks very much, Jane. Unless anyone has a really pressing question that they need Jane to answer at once, I think we might proceed more smoothly on reflection if we take our second speaker first and then have questions where each of the speakers will be free to comment on the question or on any observation any of you want to make. So let me then introduce Phil Grandinning. As I've mentioned already, Phil is the director of the Edmund Rice Centre. The Edmund Rice Centre is a non-profit social justice organisation founded by the Christian Brothers and based in Sydney. It undertakes research, community education, advocacy and networking with a particular focus on servicing the needs of Indigenous peoples, refugees and asylum seekers. The centre has produced two research reports which follow up on the fate of asylum seekers who have been deported by Australia after their claims of refugee status have been refused. Phil was on the research team for these investigative reports. In addition, he co-produced and features in the documentary which we are to view today, A Well-Founded Fear. Phil is also the National President of Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation. With a background in education, third world development and political science, today he is primarily involved in peace and reconciliation work, especially with youth, in Australia, Northern Ireland, Israel and Palestine, Rwanda, and with Aboriginal Australia. Phil.